The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hola!
Ni hao!
Guten Tag!
Moi!
Privet!
Alan?
Hey?
Hey, hello?
Hey, what's that?
That's what they say in Norway.
Alright. Welcome, everybody, one and all, to the Normal Not Normal podcast with myself, Oliver Phelps.
And me, James Phelps, and thank you very much for joining us this week, everybody. If we didn't say hello in your native tongue, we apologise profusely.
Exactly. Blame James. I've been trying to teach him all these different wonderful ways to greet people, and yet he still gets hung up with hey, hey.
Yes. Anyway, in this series, we're talking at some of our favourite people to find out what normal means to them. And really, does normal even exist?
With that in mind, our first guest today, Tom...
Our only guest today, Tom.
Pardon?
Our only guest today.
Okay.
You said our first guest today.
Right, let's do that bit all over.
No, I'm enjoying this.
No. Wait. Let's do that again.
Come on.
Let's do it again.
As you can probably tell, it's a bit late because we had to speak to our guest a bit later in the day because of the time difference. And Oliver's flagging a little bit. But today,
I wouldn't say I'm flagging a little bit. I've just had a bit of an emotional day at the checkout in the supermarket. That took a long time.
Okay, we'll talk about that later, shall we?
We'll talk about all that later. But then, I bought a leaf collector, right?
Oh God, yeah.
And so I had to collect all these leaves because obviously all the foliage is coming all over the floor. So I vacuum it all up, and then it gets stuck because there's a few wet leaves, and it mulches it down, and it leaves it like a little blockage, right? So I'm in the front lawn today, and I take off the bag because it clicks into a bag, and I was just like, quick look around. Oh. So you turn it on again, it'll literally just fire it out. There was a young lady taking her daughter to school, and it landed just in front of them. Luckily, it didn't hit them, but it landed just in front of them today. And I heard, you know, because at first, to the untrained eye, it looks like a really small hurt animal just splatting on the floor because you got all these leaves which are all wet and congealed together. And I hid there for what seemed an eternity, hoping that they would go. So then I left the rest of the stuff outside because I didn't want the lady to walk past the house and see me there.
Oh dear.
Any interesting cameos this week?
I had a really good one, actually. I had a proposal.
Right, okay. For you then, or you were helping someone else do it?
I was helping someone else do it. And I also had a really nice... baby reveal, gender reveal party. So the to be grandmother sent me a message asking me to do the reveal. So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, nice.
Really exciting to do that. But anyway, on with today's episode. You might know today's guest as Luther Hargreaves or Sir Percival or Billy Bones or even Dick and Tarly. This actor has starred in some of our most favourite TV shows, whether it's BBC's Merlin or HBO's Game of Thrones or most recently the Netflix great show Umbrella Academy. Known for his impressive physique, and we've seen this up close, it is very impressive. Tom Hopper
I think James has got a bit of a man crush on our guest today.
I have. Anyway, Tom's become something of a health expert.
What was that?
Oh, Tom. We're not even there yet. You're ruining this intro. I'm doing very well.
Sorry. Kick on.
So Tom's become something of a health expert recently. And did you know, Oliver, he's actually writing a... book about clean eating as we speak, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. He also co-hosts a podcast called Earth Locker, and Recently, his own son, Freddie, was diagnosed with autism. Tom and his wife, Laura, have taken to social media to celebrate neurodiversity and get everyone talking about autism. So I'm very excited to talk to him about that as well. As you can probably tell, Oliver, I've already got a bit of a man crush. So until then, let's crack on. Welcome, Tom Hopper. We were saying earlier about when we met. So how long ago was that? That was...
Oh, man. 2013, was it? 2012, 2013, somewhere around that. I think
a couple of years, quite a few years ago now. It's when the Lions was on, wasn't it, in Australia?
Yeah, it was the Lions tour in Australia. Yeah, and we won the tour when we were there in Australia. I mean, it was quite a moment that.
Yeah, it was something. So for people who don't know what we're on about, the Lions is a rugby tour of all four, like England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and they all like the best players come together to play for one team, and every 4 years they play either in Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. We all just so happened to be in Australia and, yeah, we experienced a Lions win.
Oh, my God, yeah. It was so tense.
The weirdest thing about watching that is that we were at this, it was like a meet and greet meal type thing, but they said, oh, we'll put the rugby on as well. So there was quite a few of us just watching the rugby. And I remember that they missed the kick. The Aussies missed a kick. So for those people who were caring for rugby at the time in the room were kind of like, oh. And out of nowhere, David Hasselhoff rocks up going, yeah! And like almost like backtracked into the distance. It was the most random thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Hoff, he loves to make an entrance, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Had no idea what was going on in the game.
So our thing is normal, what's normal, and everything in between. So what was your normal growing up? What was a classic Sunday, for example, with you?
Classic Sunday? Probably as a kid, I would say playing rugby in the morning. Speaking of which, yeah, I would get up and I remember very cold mornings and going up and going to rugby training or going to a rugby game and playing that till around sort of like lunchtime. And then my mum would always have some kind of roast. So to give you a bit of background, like I grew up in a single parent home, so my mum raised me and my brother alone. So she would try and be, we'd see my dad. My dad lived down in Bristol. We'd see him like every other weekend or whatever, and go on holidays with him. But primarily my mum raised us alone, and she always tried to do everything that was like the mum and the dad, you know. So she would always make sure she'd be there for our rugby games and watch us play football or whatever and all our sports, and then she'd always make sure that she would have dinner on the table and have a roast, you know, at lunchtime. But I come from very humble beginnings, really. I come from a miners town, an old miners town called Colville in Leicestershire. And, we would live a very simple life, really. Like the idea of doing what I do now seemed so far removed from what the life I lived then. It just like almost seemed impossible, really, to kind of reach that. Which I suppose is the reason why I ended up doing it, because I saw it as something unreachable, and I've always kind of reached for the unreachable. Because my granddad, who was a big part of my life, always said, "Go for your dreams. Never ever not go for your dreams." So even though it felt unreachable at the time, it always felt like something that I had to go towards no matter what. And kind of, I never wanted to do, like, this is the thing that's what interested, like the word normal. It's like I never wanted to go into the norm of like that town, which was sort of just go down that standard route. And, you know, a lot of people ended up sort of on the dole or like just going into some apprenticeship. And I was like, I just could never see myself going down that route. But for the most part, yeah, my childhood was very normal, for want of another word, you know.
How did you get into the drama side then?
Basically, it's a really funny story, this. So I don't know if when you were at school, how you guys did it, but when you're going into your GCSEs, you had like a choice subject that you could like choose. There was like a whole different load of subjects, and like PE might be in one and all those. And I had this free choice subject available. So one of them was drama. And I was like, that sounds like a DOS subject. That sounds like something I can DOS around in and not have to do too much work, right? And I decided to take it, and it ended up being the thing that I enjoyed the most, because little did I know, like growing up, I was always goofing around and like playing characters for like my family and just like pretending to be people. Like I'd be watching Prime Minister's Question Time with my grandparents, and I'll be doing impressions of like John Major and Tony Blair and stuff. And I'd always be doing like impressions and stuff. So I never really knew that I was kind of a performer at heart anyway. But I suppose when I got into doing drama at GCSE, that was when I was like, oh man, I quite enjoy this. I get a kick out of it. And you know what's interesting is I started to get, because I'd always done sport. That's one thing I'd always done. I'd always like played different sports. I started to get the same kick out of performing as I did at performing on a sports field. That kind of thing of, you know, that kind of elation feeling you get when you score a goal or a try, or you like you crack a brilliant shot at cricket. And that was part of the kind of the bug that I got, really, that enjoyment factor of enjoying the win, I suppose, that it was like, yes, that was a good performance.
Was there more of a like a play that you did what really caught your imagination?
I mean, there's a couple really, but there was one particular one that really stands out in my mind of when I was at school. And I did a musical. And I at the time, I used to sing a little bit as well. You know, I don't anymore, boys. It's,
you can do now if you want to, mate. We're always after a jingle.
Yeah. I'll come up with something for you. But they so there was this musical, and so I'm this robot on roller skates, and I'd seen this musical like years before when I was a kid. So the idea of playing this guy, this roller skater robot, was quite appealing to me. So anyway, I ended up doing the job, getting the part, and I've never had such an incredible feeling every single night I went on stage. It was like this. It was the closest thing I'd feel to like magic. It really felt like magic. And that was the first time, I think, where I thought I would want to do it forever. But it felt so unreachable from this like little school in middle of Leicestershire. I was like, well, even the idea of actually doing anything like that, going down to London, seemed huge for me. It's probably the same as you boys, like when you were younger. Like London seemed like this massive place.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always remember we went as kids once with our parents, and we had to dress up, like wear smart trousers type thing.
Yeah, yeah. put your smart trousers on.
Yeah, yeah. It was.
You may see the queen.
You may see the queen.
Put a belt on, James.
Yeah, exactly.
Although we did randomly see Brian May on Oxford Street. And I was like, wow, that happens every day, yeah.
Oh, what a win. I saw Bob Hoskins once on a school trip to London, and he went into Ralph Lauren, and me and my mate went in there, and he went in with his, he got his notepad out, his little rucksack, my mate, and got his notepad out and went over to Bob Hoskins and went, can I have your autograph? Like that. And he went, not right now. And we were like, oh.
I get it.
Yeah. We're like, I'm never watching Hook again.
Following your granny's advice, like never always go for your dream. You went to college to study it afterwards.
I knew nothing about drama school. I'd heard of a couple of them. It was my drama teacher at the time. She knew a kid that went to Rose Bruford College. And she was like, you should go and audition there. And that was the only one that I knew of or had heard of. And she was like, you should audition there. I always felt, this was the thing with me as well, like I never felt I was very good. I always felt like there was people better than me, because even in my school year, you know, there was people that were stronger actors than me for sure, but I always felt like I could give my best. That's one thing I always did, was I gave my best. I worked super hard. I would always like look to improve, and I wanted to learn. That was the biggest thing. I was like a sponge. I just wanted to learn. I wanted to know how to do it better. And I would watch those actors that were better than me and go, what is it that he's doing? I was like, oh, that's good. I've not seen it done like that before. And I still do that now. Like I always tell Robert Sheehan, who plays Klaus in the Umbrella Academy, like there was one scene where I was watching him and my line was next. And I was too busy enjoying his performance and like going, man, that's good. That's good what he's doing. I wonder, it's really good. And then there was this silence after he finished his line. I was like,
eyes just looking
weird.
At you.
And everyone's looking at me. I'm going, yeah. Like that, like completely out of the scene. But yeah, so that's one thing that I always struggle with as a young performer, I think, that I never really felt like I was good enough, especially when getting into drama school, you know, you have to do Shakespeare and you have to, there's all this criteria that you have to do to get in. And I really knew nothing about Shakespeare going to college. And you had to do this big Shakespeare monologue to get in. And I went in, did a poor version at best. The head of act at the time came up to me and said, can we just see you for a second? And I was like, yeah, sure. And still like bricking it, you know, I was like so nervous. And he was like, have you done much Shakespeare before? And I went, a little bit, you know, not loads, but like a little bit. And he was like, yeah, because it was awful. He goes, Shakespeare was awful. He goes, your contemporary was very good. So we'll see you again, but I want you to go and work on your Shakespeare. Go and find someone, get an acting teacher and work on your Shakespeare and come back for the recall. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. So I kind of left with this real like bittersweet feeling of like, oh my God, I've no idea how to fix this. But anyway, I was fortunate enough to be a part of Leicestershire Youth Arts, which is like a thing that take plays up to Edinburgh Fringe Festival and stuff. And there was a guy there called Bob who would like run the whole thing. And I just went and spoke to him and said, I need my Shakespeare to be better. And we spent like an entire week every day working on my Shakespeare and trying to make it better. And I went back for my recall. And then fortunately, when I got through to that final stage at the drama school, the head of acting came with him at the end. And he was like, better. Better like that. I was like,
thanks.
Good. Okay. Yeah. Good. And then fortunately I got into Rose Bruford, and then that was the beginning of three amazing years of my life where I continued to have that kind of, my attitude was, I'm not as good as any of these people here. I need to learn to be better and to be like the best version of what I can be to go out into the industry. We had this guy that came in and was like talking to us about how to stand out in the industry. At the time, I happened to be reading like a bunch of different things on Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was like a random thing that I was just happened to be reading. And I saw that he had branded himself. One thing he wanted to do was stand out. So he was like, I'd get a bunch of muscle to stand out. And one thing they told you to do at drama school, right? Because it's all about opening up and like being free and like all this, right? They're like, don't do weights. They said, don't do weights. And that was like a moth to a flame for me, because I was reading all this stuff about Arnie and about branding himself. And I was thinking, you know what? There's not that many like British guys out there like that are a little bit bigger and have got a bit of muscle on them and sort of stand out in that way. And I was like, I'm going to start hitting the weights. Screw it. I remember coming back after the summer and I'd hit it really hard. You know, I'd like been training every single day. And I when I first went to drama school, and because of the first year, they told us to not do weights or anything. I, you know, became a complete beanpole. I was so skinny. And then started like smashing the weights over this one summer into second and third year. And I remember my movement teacher at drama school going, you've put on some muscle, Tom. Are you doing weights? Like that. And I went, no. just blatantly lying. All my mates there knew that I was doing it. So there was this kind of silence in the room. And I went, no, it's weird, isn't it? And they were like, yeah, I mean, you really like put on some like muscle on your shoulders and your arms. And I went, yeah. So the same thing happened to my brother. We just naturally kind of like have done this. Then it must be genetics or something. And I mean, it was hilariously obvious that I'd clearly been doing weights, but I just blatantly denied it. So that when I got into the first year of graduating, I was going put up for roles like a debt collector with a baby face, you know, or something like that. I was like, that's me. Yeah. So, you know, like there were certain roles that just, it wouldn't be a lot, you know, that's the thing. My agent said to me when he took me on, he was like, I don't know necessarily where you're going to fit in the industry because there's not that many roles that come up for someone like you. But when they do, I think you might have a good chance. That's how I sort of started to get a bit of momentum, I suppose, and that was all because I went, well, why do we not want to, shouldn't we be doing weights? You know, like it's, and I think sometimes you do need to question whether those sort of rules, so to speak, are actually for the benefit of you and your career. Yes, you might get freer shoulders, but are you going to get a career and jobs because you've got freer shoulders? Probably not.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, did you find as well, though, that like with the whole training process, did you find yourself, so like when you went into roles, say like in Merlin or in Black Sails, where obviously the part demanded a presence, mm-hmm. shall we say, in your physique, did that in your head be like, right, I need to bulk up, I need to get to, I don't know, a body fat percentage I need to get to or something like that? Did that all come into the prep as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I look back now on those times and I put a lot of pressure on myself. There was a point where, remember when like 300 and things like that came out and like
yeah.
Different movies where people were like jacked and it was all about they'd gone through this crazy transition and stuff. Well, when we did Black Sails, that was kind of seen as like our version of that. It was like, we have to look this good. And our trainers and the people that were on the show were saying that, you know, and we were having to send photos to the network and see how we're looking and everything. And so we kind of put that pressure on ourselves. We weren't really getting it from them, but we put it on ourselves and thought, right, this is the opportunity to be the best shape of our lives. And that probably, looking back, wasn't that healthy, really. I actually made some mistakes in that period where I ended up getting injured and have learned from those things and thought, you know, that's not the way to do it, you know.
Yeah.
So I think I met you boys when I was in the middle of like kind of going quite hard.
You were training because we made the mistake of doing a circuit session with you at the hotel. And I've never looked at a medicine ball the same way since.
That's right.
Definitely. When you say you had an injury, it wasn't it wasn't like you banged your foot though, was it?
No, I mean I've had a couple, but yeah, I herniated two discs in my back. Yeah, it was pretty bad. Like for 2 years, it was probably about a year and a half from the injury actually happening. It was about a year and a half of me trying to deal with this searing pain. And I shot this third and fourth season of Black Sails with this injury. And every doctor that I saw was like, you're going to have that disc snipped off. You know, it's like pushing on your nerve and everything. I just didn't want to do that. Like it was like this thing of questioning, well, why? Why? There's got to be another way. And then I came across a stem cell company that do stem cell injections taken from your bone marrow, and they spin it and turn it into stem cells and then inject it under ultrasound into the injured area. So I went and had this thing done in Denver, Colorado, and it healed the disc. Like I woke up two months after the procedure, after 2 years of solid pain, like this waking up every single day with this searing pain down my leg and my back and just having to try and carry on. I mean, it aged me, that injury, it really did. And I woke up and was like, I got out of bed and I went to the toilet, like just as normal, like, and normally I'd be like, ugh, like I'd have this pain. And I didn't realize until I was whizzing that I was like, hang on a minute, where's the pain? And then as I was whizzing, I was so excited that I started bending over like this. So I was like, oh, the pee.
Yeah.
And I was like testing it out and I was like, oh my God, the pain's gone. And it was like this miraculous thing that happened.
Umbrella Academy, congratulations on a very big success of all that, by the way.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's good.
I assume part of it is a bodysuit. With what were you wearing to do stuff like that? I assume.
Just not my legs.
Yeah, just a little bit, yeah. Did you have to do like any training for that at all? Or was it a case of, we'll work around you with the prosthetics and stuff?
So initially, the first season, the first conversations I had was to bulk up as much as possible for the role because they were going to add like bits of prosthetic to my existing body. So I started like bulking up and was like hitting the creatine and trying to get as massive as I could. So at the start of season one, like I'm like pretty big. And, but as we were about to start shooting, they said to me, it's going to be a lot easier to do a suit because you're going to have to be in prosthetics for like 3 hours every single morning otherwise. So we'll do a suit and then we'll do a prosthetic job for when you've not got your clothes on and stuff. So I was like, oh, okay. But I'd been bulking up for like the last like 4 months. So I immediately was like, right, I'm trimming down these calories. So I gradually kind of leaned down throughout the season. And So you can kind of see that in season one. You can kind of the continuity is pretty bad because I started to slim down. Then in season two, I'm sort of more my fighting weight. But the only thing that happened in terms of training after that, once I knew it was going to be a suit, it was more like the fight scenes and stuff, right? I had to figure out how I was going to fight in this massive suit because it completely changes the dynamics of your body and like the weight that you're carrying. So you're carrying like, I'd say another like 20 pounds of weight really. So when you're doing like the big kicks and stuff that my character does, it's, I had to start to learn how to do that. So like I started doing fight training on my own with a weighted vest all the time. So I always had that extra weight and I was doing like jumping kicks and stuff. So when I didn't have the weighted vest or the suit on, I felt like lightning, you know, cause it was like, you just didn't have that extra weight. So that was the only real thing is like learning how to fight properly and make it look natural with the suit on, because that thing's it can be pretty cumbersome.
And well, Oliver and I have seen it as well. Being a tall guy in acting isn't as common as being a smaller guy in acting, shall we say?
Yeah.
Do you always get the "oh wow, you're tall" comment when you walk
yes.
in? I'm still trying to figure out how the best way to deal with that, because I'm always like, thanks.
Yes. Your average height?
Yeah, exactly. Pat them on the head.
Yeah, exactly. Like little hobbits. Hello. Hello, followers.
I remember when we were filming Potter, and there was times when we'd be doing a scene, sat down, and obviously everyone's relatively the same bit, and then we'd have to do another bit where we'd be standing up. And we would either be right towards the back, or the people we'd be talking to would literally be on an apple box. So they're not quite level, yeah. hold, but they're still like around here to try and keep it with that thing. I suppose I don't quite understand why that is. But
yeah, the logistics of shooting being a taller actor, I think, are tough, right? Because you either get the other actor on a box, like you say, and then on Black Sails, right? When we were doing a beach scene, instead of bringing a box in, they'd dig a hole for me in the sand. So I'd just been stood in this little ditch. And then, like Luke Arnold, who played John Silver, hated doing scenes with me because they'd all, I mean, I think he had a bit of a short man complex anyway. But even though he's not actually that small, but I think I gave him it, you know.
Yeah.
But they always had to, there'd be this like shout out, "Okay, can we bring in Luke's box?" all the time. And he must have hated it.
I always find you always seem to end up not falling out with, but there's always an odd look from the boom operator as well.
Well, like, we'll tell you the funniest one is like makeup artists or people coming to do hair.
Yeah, yeah.
That I just constantly, my leg strength's amazing by the end of a shoot because I just go into the deep squat every time. Just let them do their thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the thing that people don't quite understand if they're a bit shorter, or shall we say normal height. Mine, our normal is anytime you go into a hotel room, the sink is predominantly really low and stuff like that, I find anyway.
Really low, as are
yes,
toilets.
That's my excuse for my aim anyway, yeah.
Shower heads are the worst in hotels.
Shower heads. Yeah, shower heads are particularly bad.
I can remember we were doing a premiere in Amsterdam, and we're staying in this hotel, which was kind of like a load of houses, which they just knocked through and made into one big hotel.
Oh, yeah.
Or big townhouses. But all the beams in between were quite low. And I remember the one morning I got up to get out of bed, and I jumped up, but this beam was only about 5 foot tall. I'm 6'3". I literally knocked myself out and woke up a couple of minutes later, like with a huge egg on my head.
Oh my God.
Which is bizarre coming from the country which has statistically got the tallest people on the planet.
Yeah.
I know. That's what surprised me about it.
Jesus.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything.
I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome to the bit of the podcast where we answer your questions and read out your did you knows. So we're going to start with a question from Amelia from Argentina.
This is a question. What was your first job before the movies and how was it for you?
What was your first job before the movies? Well, I guess we were at a car washing job when we were kids, I don't know. But no, definitely...
I don't think washing people's cars in the church car park quite counts as a job. But I did actually, because in school over here we have to do a work placement for 2 weeks when you're about 16 or so. And I remember going along to this work placement and I was put in an office which was actually for a job recruitment company. And I really enjoyed it actually. But then at the end of it, the manager, I remember, came in with a card, had everyone in the office, which is over like three floors, had signed it saying, thanks for coming in, great, well done. And he said to me, look, I know that you're at school now, but when you finish school, are you going to go into sixth form? Or have you ever thought about coming to work here full time? Because we'd love to have you on a full-time placement. And he had no idea that I was acting or anything. And I just said, no, I'm good, thank you. I'm really good, thank you. I've already got a job.
He probably put his neck on the line to get you that.
He probably did, yeah. He's probably thought, oh, God, some 16-year-old kid in a suit has just sort of turned me down for a full-time placement.
There you go. I absolutely hated my work experience.
Why was that?
I worked in a travel agent, and it was so dull because I wasn't allowed to do anything. They had, like, a kind of WAP. They didn't have the internet on the computers at the time. So I couldn't even look at the places where they were saying. And the brochures were... I wasn't even allowed to file up the brochures. So, yeah, I was not offered a job. There you go.
We nearly had a James rant there.
We did.
Going on, question two. This is from Sophie in Dudley in the West Midlands in England. She writes, hello, in my native tongue is probably, where are you, Bab? Yeah, I'm all right. Or, how am ya? For those of you who are wondering, may I translate to you, that means, hello, how are you? Our mum's side of the family are from that part of the world. So anyway, warro, Sophie. I have a question. I wondered if you ever considered participating on a reality TV show, and if so, which one? Strictly, I'm a Celeb, Dancing on Ice. James, question to you.
I've never thought about it, to be honest with you. I'd probably do The Jungle. The Jungle's a good laugh, isn't it?
I couldn't do that.
I would vote for you to get locked in the box with rats or something.
Yeah, that's it. Really tight confined spaces wouldn't do good in that, and definitely wouldn't do with rats around, and especially add not a lot of food to the mix after that time period. No, I wouldn't do that either. I'd do the dancing, though.
Really?
I know, not to give the game away but for our chat with Ivana Lynch, but we talk about Dancing with the Stars and stuff like that, and that sounded like good.
Yeah, but she can dance, though.
Yeah, I know, that is one drawback to my skill set.
You were that weird kid on a school disco who'd stand in the corner eating crisps.
I saw you at a school disco once.
I was tearing it up. The next question. Hello, Oliver. Hello, James. I'm Finja from Germany, and since I work in a bakery, I thought I would give you a couple of did you know facts about bread.
Did Finja send any samples over?
I think we can request this for a later date.
Okay.
So did you know? Napoleon gave a common bread its name when he demanded a loaf of dark rye bread for his horse during the Prussian campaign.
Pan pour Nicole,
he ordered, which meant bread for Nicole, his horse. To Germanic ears, the request sounded like Pampernickel.
Or was it sounding like Pampernickel?
Which is still the term that in Germany they use for this traditional loaf to this day. And another legend has it, did you know? Legend has it that whoever eats the last piece of bread has to kiss the cook. A baker definitely made that tradition up.
Dorelli Belaine dropped us a message and has said, did you know that when dogs are playing and they get intense, they sneeze? The sneeze is a signal to the playmate that they're still in a playful mood and that they're safe. So basically it means they're having fun.
Very good. I can actually completely agree with that one because my dog does it all the time.
Achoo. And he's not feeling a bit rough. We also have a voice note from Rhea who told us about her new normal.
Hey, or as it's said in my native tongue, Namaste. I'm Ria from India, and since I'm a student, you can already guess that my normal is attending online classes in pajamas. But my newly found passion, thanks to lockdown, which I'd call just slightly abnormal, is going from 6 p.m. to 5 a.m. That's 11 hours, spending the time to write. I sit for hours together writing short stories for schools, organizing book exchanges and book drives to give the underprivileged a chance to read new stories. But apart from being the escapism that I need, this podcast has given me the motivation to get back to my instruments. I play the piano, the guitar, and the ukulele. And I've gotten back to my grade level, so thank you so much for helping me do that. And thank you so much for putting this wonderful podcast out there for all of us to listen to.
Wow! Ria is a very productive person, isn't she? I mean, she's putting us to shame. I mean, you know, the fact that she's openly admitting as well that she goes to school in her pyjamas now, online granted. I thought that was very, very cool. But Ria, keep being fantastic, and hello to everybody else out there in India.
Yes, thank you very much for getting in touch, Ria. That was very good, and you've put us all to shame. Now, that I want to say as well, thank you so much for all your messages. I'm sorry we haven't been able to get all of the Digi Knows and all the other messages in, but please keep sending them in. And remember, we really want to hear your voices, messages, jingles, as well as your did you knows and questions. So please send us them to normalnotnormalpodcast@gmail.com. That's normalnotnormalpodcast@gmail.com. Or tweet us with the hashtags normalnotnormal and did you know.
And if you're sending us a voice note or jingle and you're under 18, please remember, and this is very, very important, to make sure that you get permission from your parent or guardian. Now, let's get back to our interview with Tom.
You're married, your wife also acts, you've got a daughter and son. So when you're away traveling, how do you, like, when I go away, I've kind of got a switch where I, although I know I'm going to miss home, I can't think about it too much because I won't be able to focus on that. But then I'll still check in with my wife when I'm away, mainly to video time the dog. But
yeah, it's important.
Exactly.
It's important. He needs to see you.
Does she understand it as also because she does the same kind of job?
Yeah, she does understand it. My wife's incredible. Like she's so understanding of me going away. And honestly, I don't know how she does it sometimes because I spend a day alone with those children and I'm absolutely zapped. So I don't know how she does it 24/7 when I'm away. But I think it's twofold, you know, because there's a great understanding there because she understands what I'm doing and how it all works and like why I might not be able to talk to her for 12 hours in the day because I'm here, there or whatever, got terrible signal because I'm shooting up a mountain or something. But she, you know, it's also very hard because she ultimately will want to be doing what I'm doing when she's not being a mum, you know. And and I think it is hard for actors, like female actors who want to still be doing it, and they're also trying to be a mum, a full-time mum. It's an incredibly hard transition for them. I think unless as a male actor, you know, you're going to have kids and then decide you're going to be a house husband, you know, we have it a lot easier because there's a connection between a mum and their kids, you know, like, well, certainly in our case where it's unlike any other, like it's different to the connection I have with the kids. And she also feels she needs to be with them. So when she goes off to work, she gets this extreme guilt. I get the same guilt when I go away. But there's something that there's a motherly nature connection that they have that is, you know, it's unlike any other.
So, I mean, you talk about obviously with your wife as well, acting, and obviously the two of you are obviously very good at performing, and not just performing, but just being open and getting messages across and stuff. So do you want to tell us about your YouTube channel that you use for, again, with your family life and stuff like that, about raising awareness for autism with your little lad Freddie?
Yeah. So that was something that, so we got, for people who don't know, we got the news, a diagnosis that Freddie, my son, who's five, we got the diagnosis of him having autism. And we always kind of knew there was something different with Freddie. You know, he wasn't neurotypical, let's say, because he didn't start talking, and the way he was responding and stuff was not the same as other children his age. The one thing we realized was that we went through a very tough period as parents with the acceptance of that. And it felt like a very lonely time, you know, because I think particularly for Laura, my wife, because you feel, I think certainly in Laura's case, she felt like she'd done something wrong. You know, there's this thing where you feel like, oh, what could we have done different? Have we done something wrong? Because the thing is, there's also different types of autism's a spectrum, right? So there's one side of autism where the people can talk and they're like, they're very highly functioning. And then there's the type of autism that Freddie's got, which is nonverbal and doesn't communicate conventionally in any way at all. So it's very difficult. Life can be very tricky at times, but at the same time, it's incredibly rewarding because he sees life completely different to anyone neurotypical. He will be excited by snow like any other kid. Honestly, the excitement that comes over that kid, or like a tree blowing in the wind, is the most incredible thing to this kid. Like the rain falling from the sky, the way it drops on the patio, he's like obsessed with it, because the way he sees it, the way his brain processes it, is completely different. And so that's the kind of the thrill enjoyment side of his personality and the way he is. And he's an amazing little kid. But in terms of him entering our world and the things we need from him to do, it's a very difficult process, because you're trying to mold them to fit into your world, when actually we learned through the process of him being diagnosed that actually you kind of have to embrace his world. You're kind of going to jump into his world, which is a very different one. But because it can be so difficult at times, and because they're not developing like these other children you see around them, I think as parents, you go through this denial and this process of acceptance, like I say. And it was very hard for me and my wife. And when we got the diagnosis, Laura, my wife, came and said to me, she said, I feel like we need to, because we have somewhat of a platform, I feel like we need to talk about this a bit more openly and tell other parents that might be going through this and might be feeling really, really alone and feeling like they don't understand what's going on. They don't understand why they might be feeling the way they were feeling. So we were thinking, well, let's just talk about our process. Let's talk about our experience as best we can, as openly as we can, and about how it affects like a marriage as well, like the relationship between the mum and dad, because that was the toughest thing really, because you both have different views on what's going on. Like I was very quick to go, there's something up here. Let's sort it. There's something not quite as it should be. Let's try and get on top of it. I think it might be this. I think it might be that. And me being me, just like went crazy on research and was looking to all the ways we can help his life and make life easier for Freddie. And my wife being in denial for a lot of it and saying, no, he's absolutely fine. Like if I mentioned autism, it would be like a really bad thing. So we were kind of on two separate paths, you know, and eventually we came together on it. You know, we kind of found this common ground of how to deal with this thing that had come into our lives as a thing. So ultimately it all came down to, we want the best for Freddie. We adore him beyond belief, and we just want to make sure that he has the best life, because he's entering into a life where people don't see it the same way he does. So that's scary for a parent, because you want the best for them and you just want them to be happy ultimately. So we have looked at all the different ways that we would make sure that he's going to be happy in now and in the future. And we want other parents to feel that they're not alone ultimately, because it's a tough process, man.
Yeah, because it's almost, I mean, it kind of goes with what we've been trying to get out with this in terms of like this normality. Like, you know, Freddie's normality is different to, say, someone in a normal school environment type thing. But it doesn't mean that it's any, there's a good or bad to it, just a different type of normal. And yeah, as I say, like, I suppose with the neurodiversity element, what comes with that type of stuff. But I mean, did you, when you were going through like all the researching and stuff like that, did you realize that there was, say, there's an environment you put him in, what makes it better for him to deal with stuff, be it like food, be it like warmth or anything like that? Is there stuff like that that you came across?
Yeah, I mean, there's various different things. The biggest one we came across, and this is very controversial because there's a lot of people on the spectrum that argue this, that's why I always go back to, there's very different types of autism. And in our case, this worked particularly well, was that with food, it was a huge one for us. One common thing with a lot of people with autism that are like Freddie, they have a very particular kind of food that they will eat, right? Because it's to do with texture and to do with the sensory element of food as well as with the taste. And Freddie went down this route of only wanting a certain type of food, and he's always want like things with sugar in and like highly processed, ultra processed food ultimately. And it started to get to a point where it's all he ate, and that also created the divide again between me and Laura, because you know she was like, he's got to eat something, Tom, you know. And I was like, but he can't eat that, like he just can't keep eating that. And she was like, what do you want me to do, starve him? And it became this divide, and we had to then find that common ground of like, okay, well, neither of us want him to be eating that. And it was also doing terrible things to his behavior. He was acting, I can't even describe it, like it was almost animalistic at times, you know, like I just was looking at this kid that I was like, I've lost my son. Like, he's not what he was when he was 18 months. He's like, I don't know how to fix this. And for me, that was a nightmare, because all I do is look at things and think, right, how can I fix this? How can I make this better or right? And Freddie, in a way, has become my and Laura's like ultimate kind of life challenge to make sure that he is okay. So like, this is why I go delve into the research and stuff. And I started coming across people's experiences that had done this thing with food and cutting out certain things in their diet. So such as sugar, dairy and gluten or anything ultra processed. And me and Laura kind of agreed that we would try this. And as we did that, we saw Freddie change. Like, he became so much calmer. He just wasn't as angry, wasn't as frustrated. There was something that happened. I don't know what it was. There was something in his gut, because there's a lot of research now to do with microbiota transplant, which is the microbiome. So like all your gut bacteria, they do microbiota transplants now. So they transplant the bacteria of someone else. They take someone else's good, like healthy poo, and put it into a child with an imbalanced gut with autism. I think it was like over 50% increase in improvement in ASD behaviors, yeah. Like severe ASD behaviors. But there's this guy, Dr. Jim Adams, that's doing that at the moment at Arizona University, and he's finding some incredible links between the gut and autistic behaviors, certainly in severe autism, you know, that's closer to what Freddie is, like nonverbal autism. And there's kids that, after having these microbiota transplants, after 6 weeks of having them, never said a word in their lives, started talking. So wow. These are like kids are like 8, 9 years old who had never talked and then had these transplants. So there's clearly like a link there that's happening in certain types of research. Now, like I say, that's very controversial. There's a lot of people that would have uproar about that, and I completely understand where they're coming from. But when you have a child that all you want is, you're desperate for them to get along in this world and be happy in this world, those sort of things become a possibility to you, that they might be able to say their first word at, you know, 6, 7 years old. That's a huge thing. So that's a really positive research, you know.
Yeah. So what have you learned about autism and the way it's dealt with as a society in general?
It's tricky again, right? Because there's different types, and that's the thing. I think for the highly functioning element, it's starting to become more of an acceptance of it, I think, and there's an inclusion aspect of it. But with someone like Freddie, we've had to deal with a lot of, like, it's tricky because, like, my wife always says, you know, when she sort of went to certain mum groups and stuff when she was younger, or when Freddie was younger, and he clearly wasn't doing the same things that a lot of these kids are doing. He would be running around screaming and not conforming to what other kids were doing. And mums would give like looks like, what's he doing? You know, it would be really obvious. To them, they're probably not knowing that they're doing it, but there's this look that they're sort of giving that they, again, that's not normal. And as a parent, that's very tough, you know, like noticing that about, because they're having an opinion about your child, and that's tricky to deal with. But I think the more like conversations like this, talking about it, is great. And you know, the more me and my wife obviously trying to do the same thing, and I think conversation is the best, and this kind of long form conversation of chatting about it, and not, because I'm no expert, I'm literally like not educated on autism at all, I'm talking about from my own experience and what we've experienced with Freddie, I can say that that has made a difference for us. And just sort of looking outside the norm, looking outside the box and going, what else could be going on here? Rather than, because I think that's the thing, is that there is also a thing of like just accepting and dealing with a certain type of autism, you know, like just going, let's make the best of it. You know, like, oh, the child is like this, let's make the best of it. When I sort of look at it and go, but when your child is showing improvements in these areas, surely there's something to that.
Definitely. I mean, there was I did watch a short actually a couple of weeks ago. I'm trying to find the name of it. It was on the Disney Plus. It was basically about this guy who's got a kid and he keeps flying.
Oh, right.
And his dad gets really annoyed that he can't just stop and he keeps flying off. And in the end, he tries to like tie him down and everything like that. And it's actually a really emotional watch. It's only a short, it's not very long, but try and find the name of it now. But he basically, at the end of it, it's dedicated to all those who can fly.
I love that.
Or something like that. And it's really, really well done. But I can't remember the name of it. It was so powerful.
I love that. What a great concept.
Float.
Where can you watch that, Ollie? Do you know?
Yeah, so the show was called Float, and that was on Disney Plus. And it was...
Oh, okay.
It was so moving. It was such a great bit of, not just animation, but in terms of just... Because I was watching it going, what is this? What is going on? Why does this kid keep blowing away? And it was literally the very last bit, because like he basically, the dad... Well, I won't spoil it if you want to watch it, but the dad says something, and that makes him take a step back going...
Yeah.
Whoa, what was that? And yeah, it's only about, yeah, between 5 and 10 minutes long, but it is really, really, really powerful.
I've got to check that out.
It says right now then, Tom, what does normal mean to you? Like what is a normal day? Obviously I suppose there's two normals. There's work Tom and family Tom.
That's exactly it. So I suppose those normals kind of do cross a little bit. So normal right now when I'm on my own, like, so work Tom normal revolves around eating and training. They're the two main things. And then obviously going to work and shooting. I always find there's certain things in my life that I like to prioritize to keep my life, for want of a better word, normal, you know, and it keeps me sane as well as things that I like to do. So in between jobs, when I'm at home with a family, normal for me is doing those same things, but just fitting it around family life. So I always try and make sure I can get up with the kids and do the school run, or like get the breakfast ready or whatever. I always try and make fresh breakfast for them. So like I make Freddie like his own little like sugar-free, grain-free pudding thing every night that I cook. And like there's these certain routine things that I do for the family as well. And then outside of that, I always make sure I go and train. You know, I get like an hour where I'm like, right, this is training time, and I train like a maniac for that hour. Like I'm in there and I get the job done. A big part of what I do is get up before everyone else is up. Like I wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning and get it done. And there's also a nice feeling of knowing that no one else, when you're up working, you're getting something done before anyone else has even arisen yet. You know, I quite like that feeling.
Yeah, I completely, that is exactly what I do, to be honest. There's something about, I think I saw when Mayweather was fighting Hatton, he would fight, he would train like in the middle of the night, because his theory was, well, my opposition's sleeping while I'm working.
Yeah, it's a psychological edge, right?
I don't think he'd figured out the time zone difference. But...
yeah, so that's 2 in the afternoon.
But it's 2 in the afternoon, Manchester or his. But yeah, I mean, exactly. I always find if I put it off training and say, I'll go later, it's always, I'll go a bit later. Yeah, and then if I haven't gone, I'm in like some kind of depression for that day. Like,
well, you do have to talk to yourself sometimes and just go, no, get on, just do it. You'll feel good. And you do. That's the thing. When you do it and you didn't talk yourself out of it, feels better, right? I really feel the difference.
Yeah, I think that probably brings on to this one. So what's the most normal thing about you?
I suppose the most normal thing about me is my family life. You know, I think I for me, it's very important that my kids are extremely grounded as they grow up, you know, and live what I would consider a normal life. And they're not. Because I think if there were certain places I could choose to live, you know, that it would affect their upbringing. And I suppose giving them, you know, my version of what is normal, and what my wife's version of normal is, and having lots of family around them, and Even when they travel with me around the world, you know, to wherever I'm shooting, because they're going to come out with me, you know, to certain, like they come out when I shoot Umbrella and stuff. And even then, it's like our day to day will stay what it is back home in Leicestershire, you know, like we do the same things and we have the same routines and they'll go to school and they'll do what we normally do. So that's probably the most normal thing. We have no extravagance there. It's very similar to any average family.
Yeah. And so if that's the most normal, what would be the least normal thing about you?
What would people consider out of the ordinary would be the way I eat and the way I train and the way I look at my self-discipline, I suppose, of like what people would be like, oh God, don't you ever just give yourself a treat? You know, people would see it as quite self-destructive in a lot of ways, but actually it's the opposite. For me, it's all about self-betterment. But a lot of the things, like my diet now, is what I consider normal. But to other people, they would be like, that's mad. Why do you never eat that? Why do you never have that? But to me, I'm like, well, because it's normal to me now. That's just the way I do it. But to most people, it would seem like extreme or odd, I think.
I've normally got a couple of questions to ask, which I'm always meant to send people and I never do. So quick fire ones. First of all, Tom, what's your favourite book?
Right now, one of my favourite books is a book called Genius Foods by Max Lugavere. That was one that really kind of helped me out on my journey. So I'd say that's one of my favourite books.
Nice. Favourite song?
Probably an Aerosmith song. Maybe like Love in an Elevator, I think, is pretty amazing for me. Or I've got so many, that's the thing.
What is your favourite film?
Back to the Future 2.
Oh, good. Good shout. What is your favourite food?
Really good chicken wings. When chicken wings are done well, chicken wings. Nice.
And finally, out of any film or TV show or film or whatever, what is your favourite quote?
Actually, there's one from a movie that kind of represents, I think, what was a big part of like the way I entered into, like, I need to be like that, was when Gerard Butler kicks the Persian in 300 and he goes, "This is Sparta!"
Yeah.
And he kicks the guy. That was like, yes, that's it, that. So that had a lot of weight for me.
Wiki, well, thank you very much, Tom. That's all my quick fire questions. But yeah, thank you very much for joining us, mate.
It's been a pleasure. And thanks for asking all amazing questions, especially about like Freddie and stuff and the message we're trying to get out about autism and stuff and awareness of that. So that's amazing. And you boys should come on the Earth Locker. We should have you guys on.
Yeah, that'd be
great.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll sort it out.
Definitely, mate.
Nice. Well, thanks very much, Tom.
All right, boys.
Enjoy the rest of your shoot and speak soon.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, fellas.
Cheers. Cheers, mate. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? Again, whenever we speak to people that we know, we talk about things which we've never spoken before, which is good fun. But yeah, Tom's such a nice guy. We were just saying he's so easy to hate because he's so good looking, such a nice guy. I bet he can sing. He says he couldn't sing, but I bet he can sing.
I know, yeah, he got away with that one, didn't he?
But yeah, really top bloke, and really fascinating to hear, and amazing the work that he's doing with spreading more knowledge about his son Freddie and other, hopefully helping people in a similar situation.
It's bizarre as well, though, as when he was talking about it, how little, I suppose, general people, their understanding on stuff like that is, because obviously, I suppose, like a lot of things, unless it directly affects you, you're not really going to seek it out, are you, or anything like that. So I suppose it does make a lot of sense and help as well that he's able to share his message using his platform.
Yeah, very good, very good. But that was a lot of fun. Really enjoyed that. I hope you guys enjoyed it as well.
James, is that listening to Tom then, are you going to go and hit the gym twice tomorrow? And
do you know what? I am, actually. I already was meant to, yeah. So I do morning is my cardio and weights, and then evening boxing.
Right, okay. How many calories are you on? Because you've got to be over 3,000 calories right now. For
I'm eating sure. quite a lot already.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, thank you, nutritionist okay. man.
I'm just saying, I'm just saying.
Hench. It doesn't count when you wear
the lighting right.
It doesn't count when you wear a small t-shirt, though.
What are you talking about? This t-shirt is extra large.
Yeah, Pearl Jam worldwide, yeah. But no, look, we're just really, really glad that Tom was able to join us today. It was great catching up with him.
Very much so. So, since Tom is away, and I was thinking, he's probably been on just as many planes
as we have. Is this your segue? Is this your segue as Tom is away?
Well, he is. He's in Canada, isn't he?
Well, he's in Toronto,
so he's away from home. So to get there,
about Canada?
Well, to get there, Tom would have had to take an aeroplane, I'm imagining. So, did you know? Here we go. Here's a segue. Did you know the shortest passenger flight you can get in the world is between Westray and Papa Westray in the Scotland's Orkney Islands, which is separated.
2 minutes, isn't it?
It's separated by 1.7 miles of land and sea, so the flight itself lasts 47 seconds.
Wow.
But do you know a civilization which were way ahead of their time many, many moons ago? Were the ancient Egyptians. You know, and you're going to, if you go to work and you think, my boss is a real beep. Imagine you're a slave for one of the pharaohs of Egypt, which sucks anyway. So King Pepi II, I think I pronounced that right, this dude apparently ruled for 90 years and he was really fed up with flies and other bugs pestering him. So he commanded one of his slaves to be covered in honey to lure all the bugs away from him.
Did it work?
Well, I don't know. I assume so. But imagine that for a rubbish job.
I bet his skin was soft.
Okay, I tell you what. Next time we're in the summer.
Okay, I tell you what would be a rubbish job.
What?
Did you know that when the pharaohs died and they went into their tomb, their slaves were buried alive with them to help them in the afterlife?
Not all of them.
Most of them were.
That would be like, you know, in The Simpsons where it's like, oh, Smithers, you'll be buried alive with me.
Yeah, it would be like that. I mean, that is vile. To be honest, I'm still in a wee mood from earlier today, right? So I went to the supermarket and I thought, right, I've literally got two bags of rice. Three self-checkout things, right, there. All three of them had people, idiots, standing there with their trolleys, their shopping trolleys, full of stuff. One lady was there and she was scanning individually. She must have had, I'm not exaggerating, about 50 mini lemonade bottles. Scanning them. Each one, beep, beep, beep. Oh, ring the bell. Excuse me, I've run out of space to put them on the scales here. I wonder why, because it's supposed to be a self-checkout. Minimal as possible. Get it in, pay it, get out. If you want to do it a hell of a lot quicker, here's a good idea. Go to the person over there who can actually scan it quickly for you. Do you want any cash back? Get out. Are you a people person? Because clearly you don't want to talk to someone whose job it is to scan all the contents from a shopping trolley. Rant over.
Enough of that. Thank you very much for listening this week. Thank you very much for Tom joining us all the way over there in Toronto, Canada, while he's off.
Well, no, he wasn't in Toronto. He was in the upper echelons of Ontario.
He was Ontario, yes, beautiful part of the world, but very cold now. So if you're there, stay warm. But everybody, again, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for watching on YouTube. Alice, thank you very much for editing all this together, cutting Oliver's rants out, hopefully. And
Oh, I need to add one more thing as well, because you never do it.
What?
Please subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Please click
subscribe if you're listening on audio.
No. If you like it, great. If not, no worries. I hate those. I always hate
those
videos.
No worries.
Here's my rant.
You don't like it. They'd have turned off by now, haven't they?
Here's my rant. Everybody, you're watching a how-to fact on YouTube, so you're never going to need to know again. At the end, old Bob's painting tips is, if you like this, click likes and follow us for more. So I've watched it now.
Right, but
anyway,
you realise how this works though, James. People don't miss the next episode of this, listening to all your Did You Know facts, because they subscribe. I'll tell you what we need.
A new host?
Crappy merchandise.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? You could have like, I don't know,
that
any ideas, like a
dream.
T-shirt right. Where it just says like, Did You Know?
Let's think about this until next time. But until that time, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Normal, Not Normal is a Stable production.